It's Wednesday, November 8th, 2017, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, billionaire Joe Ricketts shuts down hyperlocal sites around the world. He said it's because the business model just wasn't working, but many think there's a lot more to it than that. Newspapers across the country refused to preview Disney films after the company shut out the LA Times following an investigation into Disney's business practices in the city of Anaheim. And while we're talking about the mouse, we'll talk about the new social media policies put in place at ESPN. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before the half hour is up, but let's start with the latest investigative project to come out of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the same group that brought us the Panama Papers last year. This year's big investigation, it's called the Paradise Papers, and it gets into the offshore activities of some of the world's most powerful people and companies, among them Queen Elizabeth. The ICIJ team worked with partners from more than 95 media companies around the globe, combing through more than 13 million leaked files. So let me ask you, Mike, what did they find?
Well, they found that there are an awful lot of rich people and rich companies and institutions that are finding ways to avoid taxes or to shield from public scrutiny their holdings. So you mentioned the Queen. They also found that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, has ties to a shipping company that's connected to Vladimir Putin. They found that Madonna and Bono have invested in some interesting things to avoid taxes. They found some previous Canadian prime ministers. They found that Apple and Nike were really good at staying ahead of the game by using this company to avoid paying taxes. And then the New York Times today was a really interesting story about how a lot of private universities have been using Applebee's, this Bahamian-based company, to shield their money from their endowments from taxes, too. And that's a pretty sensitive topic right now as the tax policy is being debated in Congress.
I mean, this is all sensitive in terms of these basically rich companies and rich individuals being able to shield their taxes while we're talking about, well, at least while Congress is talking about changing the tax code. That's, and if you listen to all the analysts that have been looking over this tax structure that they want to come out with, it gives them even more opportunities to do that. So, I mean, that's I think, where you have this big link between what this investigative unit has done and where we are now in terms of taxes.
Go ahead.
And we don't know who gave the data from this company to this German newspaper, but once the German paper got it, they've shared it with journalists, as you said, from around the world. So they're kind of parsing it out and doing the stories that are most relevant to their audiences.
And the difference between this investigation and the previous investigation is that in the previous investigation, it was mainly Europeans and others around the world, whereas this one, you have more U.S.-based rich people and companies than you did in the previous
investigation. And I believe I saw the number was that there are 13 different associates of either Donald Trump or people directly involved with the administration who are listed within this.
Right.
One of the things that was kind of neat on the ICIJ's release was that it kind of had a rundown of the stories that were going to be coming out all week. This wasn't just going to be one big dump of stories. What are some of those other topics that we're supposed to be looking for either later today or even tomorrow?
Well, I mean, like I say, you've had the stories about the individuals, and you've had the stories coming out about companies like Apple and Nike. Now you've got stories coming out about others. Like I said, the New York Times today just broke this story about universities. And I don't know what else is coming, but the point of it is, if you think that these stories are like a one-week wonder, they're not. There's a lot of data there, and it's going to get parsed.
I think there's supposed to be additional stories on links between these individuals and companies in Russia.
Yeah,
that's something that seems to be a part of every one of these stories as they come out, is trying to sort of make that link between the rich people and their various political cronies, either in the United States or in Russia.
Okay, well, let's talk about this one. Maybe you've seen a commercial that has been floating around out there calling for President Trump's impeachment. It features Democratic Party backer Tom Steyer, and he's making a case for why he thinks Trump should go. Take a listen to part of it.
He's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become? I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment. A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today, people in Congress and his own administration know that this president is a clear and present danger.
When that ad first came out, the president struck back, calling Steyer wacky and unhinged on Twitter, and said that he's been fighting Trump's Make America Great Again campaign from the very beginning. Well, Fox News has decided not to honor its contract with Steyer and is pulling the ad because of what it calls negative feedback from viewers. It's not unusual for a network or for an organization to pull an ad if it's found to be inaccurate, if it's found to be full of lies, but pretty unconventional to pull it when a viewer, and I say a viewer, not knowing perhaps it's many, many viewers as Fox is letting on, but because viewers don't like it.
Yeah, that is unusual. I mean, what I'm surprised about here is that they didn't come out and say something about some of the statements that he made and that sort of thing to say, well, wait a minute, we don't have any evidence of this or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What surprised me was that they came out and said, well, our viewers were disturbed by some of the statements being made here, and that was one of the reasons we're pulling it off. But I mean, I'm not surprised mm-hmm. that you're going to see this from Fox News. I think I'm not sure whether you'd see it from MSNBC or one of the major networks, maybe, or if you would see it from CNN. But I'm surprised that they didn't come out and try to sort of attack it by saying that, you know, some of the issues here are not accurate.
I mean, I don't know this, of course, but I would suspect that they decided to let it air a couple of times, including on Fox and Friends, and then pull it, saying that it was up due to viewer complaints. That way, there's a little bit less legal liability, although yep. Steyer has said, you know, they violated the contract. At least this way, they can say, we ran the ads, we didn't do any prior restraint, but our viewers didn't. Why would a Fox News viewer like that ad, right? I mean, you can understand that, but we don't know.
Especially a Fox News viewer who has access, as I heard it reported on the Today Show this morning, to special equipment that will still let him tweet from China.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, truthfully, there's no downside, I don't think, for Fox News to do this at this point. So there you go.
Okay, so while we're talking about potentially limiting speech, if it's in advertising or in an editorial standpoint, anyone who went to check Donald Trump's Twitter on Thursday of last week, the one that's the @RealDonaldTrump account, found that it was gone. It was inaccessible. It had been deleted. Well, temporarily at least. It turns out there was a contractor who was working for Twitter. It was this person's last day of work, and they thought that it would be a good idea to pull a little bit of a prank on the last day and take down this account.
You know, I mean, this actually bothers me more than the last thing that we just talked about. And not because it's Trump's Twitter account, because it's the president of the United States yeah. Twitter account. And he uses that account, for better or for worse, to communicate on policies and his feelings and his beliefs. And for somebody who's not even an employee of Twitter, a contractor, to have the access to be able to go in and do that, I'm a little bit worried about that.
Oh, well, think about it, even if it is an employee. I mean, you're on your last day, you're getting ready to leave, you've got an axe to grind, you're going to walk in, you're just going to delete someone's Twitter account. I mean, to me, that's a security issue on the part of Twitter that they really need to deal with. I mean, it happened to President Trump. It could happen to anybody just because this individual happened to be upset about them or wanted to pull a prank or for whatever reason.
I mean, you think about Edward Snowden's not all that different. Here's a contractor at the NSA, and he leaks all the stuff for good or for ill. And at least the federal government, the NSA and the security agencies are looking for ways to tamp down on this kind of thing. Private sector, especially these big tech companies, have a lot of third-party contractors doing a lot of things, and they can create a lot of mischief, and this is just one example.
Right.
Okay, well, we are now 4 weeks out from those bombshell stories that came out that were about Harvey Weinstein and the sexual harassment scandal that gripped Hollywood. And they aren't really letting loose at any point. This week we heard that the Television Academy has ousted Harvey Weinstein, banning him and any future membership for life. And we're still awaiting word as to whether he will face criminal rape charges in New York State. Meanwhile, We're seeing the list of journalists accused of wrongdoing growing as well, and that included the ouster of NPR's now former top news editor, Michael Oreskes. He resigned under great pressure last week, and the mood inside NPR's Washington headquarters was tough as the journalists who worked there demanded answers from its leadership. Mary Louise Kelly really, really took the CEO of that organization to task in an 8.5-minute interview that I listened to a second time last night, and it was really kind of painful to listen to. She let him have it.
Not only was she tough, but there was a ring of women who work at NPR who were all looking into the studio while this was going on. And I think that it shows how seriously NPR takes the issue. And I think it's kind of a good case study for how you should react to bad news inside your own operation. Compare that to the way NBC has operated with the Weinstein story, or before that, the Access Hollywood tape. NPR, as painful as it is, has done it right so far.
Yeah, and Gerald Mann, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
You're braver than I. I got close and then I chickened out.
Well, I mean, news came down yesterday that he's stepping out for health reasons. He had just come back several months ago for health reasons, and now he's saying that one of the stipulations is that I keep my blood pressure down. Well, this definitely didn't help.
Did not help No.
So now he's stepping out. It's going to be a question, as he says, for minimum of 4 weeks, but who knows, you may not come back. So now you've got that swirling around in there, and it's going to take someone going in there and trying to figure out how do we, number one, deal with the issues that are at hand, the sexual harassment and how we handled it, and try to make sure that we're going to do better going forward. They're going to bring in a team of lawyers to look over what happened and how to do that. And this is sort of like standard operating procedure now whenever this goes down. MSNBC is dealing with it with Mark Halperin from last week. He's gone now. So now you've got, and I'm not sure that this is over. I mean, I think that it's going to continue.
Well, in fact, I mean, you mentioned Mary Louise Kelly's interview, which was really a good interview, and David Folkenflik, their media correspondent, has done a lot of aggressive reporting on this. In fact, uncovered that there was another contemporaneous complaint from within NPR, not just the ones that were reported from the New York Times many years ago. So they've done a lot of good reporting on what's been going on there. Does it tarnish their reputation? I mean, I could imagine how they'd be worried that NPR stations, for the most part around the country, this is fundraising time, just like it is here at KBIA. It can't be a great time to be aggressive in telling this kind of internal story, but better to get it out of the way and do it right.
I was going
to
say, though, is it not a great time, or is it actually the perfect time? That perhaps maybe it's an opportunity to tell the story of you know, Mary Louise Kelly holding her bosses to the fire and saying, we're trying to do good work here. Yeah. Are you going to stand in our way of doing good work, or are you going to support us? And then asking the audience at the same time to show that support.
Well, and I think that NPR is handling this in a way that other organizations should have handled it. I mean, I don't think NBC was as open as it should have been about what was going on with Mark Halperin. We know back, because we talked about it a lot, what was going on in Fox News with Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly and others. You know, they weren't
Bill O'Reilly made the settlement and then got that gigantic contract.
Or Ronan Farrow's reporting for NBC that they wouldn't release on Harvey Weinstein.
Right, exactly. So I think NPR is doing it the right way, but they're in the spotlight right now, and it's gonna take some time to figure out what's going on there.
Okay. Well, I want to talk next. We've got a lot of quick hits in today's show. So for our next one, I want to talk about something that's going on YouTube Kids. I don't have children of my own, so I didn't know or have really a reason to know there's such a subsite on YouTube until the other day when it was reported that there's something a little strange going on there. That there are bots in place that are targeting children with videos that really aren't kid appropriate. And that instead of serving up short snippets of cartoons or animal features, they're seeing some really disturbing things instead. These basically look or appear like knockoff videos that are meant to be the children's content, but have really violent undertones.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of disgusting. I mean, they had one with a claymation Spider-Man was urinating on Elsa from Frozen. They had these Nick Jr. characters at a strip club, and all this stuff slips.
This was one with like Mickey Mouse bleeding to death in a street.
Right.
And it all slips in because there are these people out there who figured out how they can create knockoffs and get past the algorithms that screen this children's content from other content.
And the at least the story that's on our links blog talks about how a parent basically ran across it because a kid was watching it and said, you know, she screamed, "Hey, Mom, the monsters are scaring me," and she looked at it and saw the bot, and apparently they don't last long. They're very short, and then it goes back to whatever that the original content is. So it's almost like you've got to catch it. If you're a parent, you got to catch it at the time that it shows up and be able to deal with it. But this is another issue going back to what we talked about earlier, where you have security breaches, and then these companies are going to have to figure out a way to deal with this.
I mean, I do think that's true, and there are some parallels to what's happening with Facebook and Google and how Congress is talking about regulating their political advertising content because they're not controlling it appropriately. I could see the same kind of conversations happening here. But, I mean, let's face it. Do you know how many millions of videos are on YouTube every day?
New ones every day.
No algorithm is going to be able to catch everything, and there aren't enough employees in the world to catch everything. So I'm not trying to sound like a holier-than-thou grandparent. We've all put our kids in front of the TV from time to time for babysitting, but today you can't do that with young children. It's the parents have got to take even more responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. You can't just hand them your iPad and walk away. You just can't do that.
Okay. I want to turn to the business of media and talk about a couple of rumored mergers and the shutting down of some organizations. The first, the abrupt end of 5 p.m. turning off of the lights at DNA Info, Gothamist, Chicagoist, Shanghaiist, all of the localist sites. Billionaire owner Joe Ricketts told his now former employees he was shutting it all down because the business model just wasn't profitable. But the scuttlebutt is that the move wasn't really just about profit, had a lot more to do with the fact that his New York employees had voted to unionize the week before.
Yeah, I think that's had everything to do with it. The fact that, you know, he did not want to have to deal with a union, and he basically put it out there. He didn't come right out and say it, but he let it be known that this was a possibility. If the union vote was yes, the vote to form a union was yes, that the likelihood would be that, you know, we were going to shut the place down, and that's exactly what he did. And what I think he's in an environment where he's going to be able to get away with this, because I would say under previous administrations, you would have had Department of Labor jump in and say, hey, well, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. But I don't think that's going to happen under this administration.
You know, this is like a lot of issues we talk about on this program. More than one thing could be true at the same time. Undoubtedly, the union vote had a lot to do with this. But I also think I would probably agree with Ricketts from a business standpoint that nobody's figured out a good business model for these hyper-local news sites to be profitable yet. Look what AOL tried to do with Patch. It's a shadow of itself because it couldn't make money. Nobody's figured out how to do this. On the other hand, I'd also say this about business models. If you're going to rely on one super wealthy benefactor to keep your news operations going, you're in a dangerous place.
That's the part that's really scary. And I think of this, I mean, here we're talking about Joe Ricketts, who does have some rather right-leaning political stances himself. So when you talk about like today's political environment and the Justice Department not being likely to step in.
Right.
Yeah, completely, especially given his support of the Republican Party. But what I was also going to ask about is what this does signal for the health of the news industry as it's funded by the billionaires. Because I think, okay, we've got Chicagoist, we've got DNA Info, we've got Gothamist. But then I also look at it from the standpoint of we have the Washington Post and Jeff Bezos, who came in and rescued one of our national newspapers of record.
But if you're going to rely on a rich person to prop you up, then your interests better coincide.
This is true.
And Jeff Bezos, for whatever reason, his interests coincide with the Washington Post.
They do today.
Right. Well, and they may not in the future.
Yeah.
But if you look at this, how could you expect a guy with the political values and views of Joe Ricketts when he's got one of his employees saying, well, what we do is report on the struggling and marginalized people who are undercovered. That's not his agenda.
But, you know, here's a problem I have with what he did. He shut them all down. several of them were profitable. Several of them were making not a huge profit, but they were at least making a profit and was showing that there was some potential there. He went in and he just basically said,
well, and he didn't just shut them down. He shut them down and he pulled the plug so that the servers were all shut down
archives,
too, and the archives all disappeared too, which to me, that doesn't just say that this is an issue of profit or not profit, because how much does it really keep to keep the archive up for a day or a week or a month?
But I think, I think Mike, you bring up a very good point. If you're going to rely on one individual or a family, I mean, to do this in this kind of environment, you're opening yourself up to these kinds of things happening. The question is that the same as if you go to a foundation? Is that the same as if you rely on stockholders? I mean, the entire environment right now for these kinds of operations are fickle. And you run into a lot of issues.
With stockholders or with a foundation, there's going to at least be some kind of a board of directors. There's a check and a balance. There's not one guy who's going to take his bat and ball and go home.
Well, that's true. But as we have seen, you can't have a large group of individuals who come in and make a statement and say, no, you're not going to do this. And they can have sway. They may not shut it down, but they can have sway within the organization.
Right. Look at what Google did with the New America Foundation. Right. Not exactly a news organization, but Eric Schmidt goes, you're taking our money and you're not reflecting that you're doing nothing but criticizing our company and how it operates in Europe. We're taking our money and running.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mentioned a merger. Really, it's more of a rumor of a merger at this point, but it's one that's moved Wall Street this week. Disney is positioning itself to buy up portions of 21st Century Fox. Which parts of that company are up on the block at this point?
Everything but the news and the sports.
Okay.
That's pretty much what's up there. And a lot of this goes back to as these companies move into basically online streaming, where you're not going to be sitting in front of a television waiting for a show to start at a certain time. You can get it on demand. These are opportunities for these companies to get more entertainment operations so that they can be able to put themselves in a position to be able to do this. And 21st Century Fox wants to sort of move away from that, have only the news and the sports, because this can help Fox and the Murdochs in their negotiations with Sky TV on the other side of the pond.
Which are a little precarious in their own right.
Exactly.
I mean, I think you're right. Those are one of the reasons why they're splitting them up is because Disney wants scale on the entertainment side. Fox wants more of a niche in sports and news. But the other reason that, for example, the Fox Sports programming is not going over to Disney is because they have ESPN.
That's
and
right.
There's going to be an antitrust question. If the Fox television network were to go over to Disney that has ABC, there'd be antitrust problems.
Right.
Okay, well, while we have Disney on the brain, I want to bring up a pretty big story that the LA Times wrote about the company and its business dealings in Anaheim that really, really angered the mouse. So much so that the LA Times has been barred, although that decision was overturned very late yesterday, from any kind of advanced screenings of Disney films. What was at the heart of this story that upset Disney so badly?
The Los Angeles Times did an investigative series about Disney and its relationship with the city of Anaheim, where Disneyland and another theme park they have is located there, all about sort of the sweetheart tax deals, the influence on development policies, even some alleged political influence, and Disney didn't like it. And Disney decided to take it out on the Los Angeles Times by saying, your film critics don't get to see advanced screens of our movies like the rest of the critics do. So that's what started it. And then when other media found out about it, out of solidarity with the Times, they said, fine, we're not going to review your movies either. And that's one of the reasons I suspect that, what was it, today or yesterday, Disney decided
that yesterday,
they were going to reverse that. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, and I think this is the part of me that as the journalist, I kind of look at the LA Times and want to give them the fist bump and look at Disney and give them the side eye. You got to think there wasn't anything in that story that was untrue if Disney simply said, you can't see our films, but didn't ask for any kind of a correction or a retraction on the story. There's no denial in that complaint.
Well, I mean, we live in an age now where, you know, whose facts are we talking about? Mm-hmm. I mean, and they don't necessarily have to come out and say, well, we're going to dispute any of your facts. We're just not going to go along with it. And we're going to either cut you off from access, or we're going to denounce you, or we may do both, which we've seen in various iterations from the current administration. So I think, you know, that Disney sort of tried to take that tack. It didn't quite work because you had pushback, especially moving into the Christmas season, mm-hmm. where Disney has got one of its biggest films coming out in Star Wars. You can't basically have all the film critics not go and see that and talk about that from that standpoint.
Let me ask each of you then. Now that Disney did reverse this decision and is opening the doors back up, who won the fight? Who's the winner?
You know, you had a link to a piece by Jack Schaefer from Politico who says Disney won, and I kind of think they did. I mean, yes, they had to give up on this ban. They were going to do that anyway. Mm-hmm. But here's a company that also owns ABC News, and just how many stories on Good Morning America are there going to be about these movies coming out over the Christmas season? How many of these reviewers who were in solidarity saying we're not going to review these movies are going to turn right back around and take all of the freebies and everything that Disney offers to write a positive review?
No, I think you're right. I think Disney won in this, mm-hmm. mainly because it came out and showed we can do it and we might do it again.
Okay, well, one last quasi-Disney related story before we go today. A new social media policy rolled out at ESPN. And many on both sides, both inside and those on the outside looking in, say some aspects of this are laughable. What is very clear if you look at it, this is most definitely about responding to the Jemele Hill tweets of the past few months.
Oh, definitely. This is one of those where Disney and ESPN, shall we say, is taking a stand and basically telling its on-air talent, if you're involved in news, if you're involved in hard news, as they put it, hard sports news, then you don't have a political opinion, you don't comment on social events, or social commentary, you don't do any of that. I'm gonna really take issue with this, because you asked them to do this when you put them out there. You asked them to be engaging in this, and now all of a sudden you wanna roll it back because—
You can't unring the bell.
Exactly, because you feel like you've gotten burned.
On the surface, though, I don't think a policy that says that you're going to talk to your producers and editors before you put out a tweet or something on social media that involves your political opinion, I don't think on the surface of that sounds like a bad policy. The one that's going to be that may be self-defeating for them, as you pointed out, Amy, is this notion that, well, from now on, you have to break all your stories first on ESPN's platforms before you can go to Twitter or Facebook to do it. And that could hurt them in terms of referrals back to their own site.
It could hurt in terms of referrals back to the site. I understand, and I've long had this discussion with students, too, and debated it, because ASNE, the American Society of News Editors, has long had that in its social media guidelines. And the idea behind it is the revenue that is generated by going to your website first and then tweet with a link, which makes sense, drive the traffic. I can get behind that, but you're also then behind the news as it happens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to me, one of the problems is now you've got people conditioned to going to Twitter, going to Facebook first, and now you want to dial it back. That's a problem.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. To those of you who watched us on Facebook Live today, thank you. We hope you have enjoyed this ongoing experiment, and we hope to keep doing it as much as we can. Tell your friends about it. And also, consider giving us a like on Twitter. You can follow us. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. And these are all great ways to follow us, watch us, listen to our program again, leave us comments and questions, see what we'll be talking about on our program next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Chelsea Preby and Allison Pecorin are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week for another edition of Views of the News.